I thought of this idea like a while ago, and the idea was, what's it called? Introductions play a very big role in many svarim, many svarim, and often, I'd say in modern day works, although I don't really read a lot of fiction. Actually, I read no fiction, but when I read nonfiction, I'll read, but introductions always set up like a certain framework for what the author will discuss. A good introduction will do that. In Svarim, what's it called? In Svarim, what's it called? It's a little bit different. What I think Svarim do is that when you have Akdamas to Svarim, when you have introductions to many Svarim, so they do really two things. Number one, often, as you see today, it's certainly the case, often they're actually like shiurim in and of themselves, meaning that in the introduction, you get like a tremendous insight into like an area of knowledge you didn't realize before, or insights about the sefer they're writing on. For instance, we'll probably do, let's say, the Ibn Ezra's introduction to Tehillim. So in that introduction, he reveals a tremendous amount about the book he's writing about. So it's a little bit different when you're writing an Hakdama to a book that's already written, and you're just a commentary. That's a little something very unique. And the other thing is that another aspect that makes Hakdamas interesting is that sometimes there's Svarim that you haven't come across that if you appreciate what the introduction tells you, it may give you some interest in pursuing it. And finally, also, you learn a lot about the writing style of the author when you read the Hakdama. And that's an important thing, too. Hakdamas play a big role in revealing the writing style, the thinking style, etc. Of these great minds. So I thought we'd start today with, and we'll see if this type of shiur is something that people are interested in. Is the sure? You're 100% correct. Often in a Hakdama, what'll happen is that the author will explain the rationale for writing the sefer. It's funny you mention it, Harvey, because specifically in Emunos Fideos, what's it called? In Emunos Fideos, Sajigon actually does explain why he's writing this sefer, but like it's he spends so little time explaining it. You know what I mean? He spends like maybe four sentences of a 35-page introduction, right, on why he's writing the book. You know what I mean? But you're right. There's no question that often, especially like something like Emunos Fideos, the author will give us an insight into why he chose to write the book. Okay, so let's go through. We'll go through the Hakdama to Emunos Fideos, and it's actually the introduction to Emunos Fideos has its own name. It's called Doubt and Certainty, and it's a and to me it's a fascinating piece of learning that really gives us, a tremendous. I used to. There was a couple summers ago where I actually sent the yeshiva guys before they came in for the year in Israel. I sent them a copy of this section of Emunos Fideos, the introduction, to read before they came to yeshiva. Because and what's amazing about this, I think, is that it actually has universal application. When you go through this, you'll see what he talks about. Doesn't really have, it's not necessarily specifically a Jewish idea. Rather, it's a universal way of how a person should approach knowledge, acquiring knowledge, understanding knowledge, how to philosophize, how to come to conclusions about truth. That's all included in this Hakdama. Okay? So let's get a little historical background. Who's Sajigon? Oh, yeah, go ahead. Okay, so Sajigon, it's interesting we don't refer to him as Sa'id ibn Yusuf al-Fayumi. I'm not sure why we don't do that, but that was actually his name. We call him Sajigon, but that was his given name. He lived from 882 to 942, so I did my little research there. And then, just if you want to know, his major works include Emunos Fideos, which we're going to talk about that, what that is in a second. He translated the Torah into Arabic, okay? And in fact, just as an example of how far he went, there is a copy of his of the Megillah that he used, Megillah's Esther, that's actually transliterated into Arabic, which is pretty cool. He wrote a lot on halacha. He wrote a lot on tefillah. He also wrote a commentary in the Torah. Anyone who has a Toras Chaim, you'll see that in there. He also wrote, for instance, a Sefer Mitzvos. He did a lot. Okay, so Sajigon was a prolific writer, certainly for that period of time. And we're going to focus on Emunos Vadeos. So what's Emunos Vadeos or Emunot Vadeot? So it is the first major work on Jewish philosophy. Okay. Up until that doesn't mean there was no philosophizing before Satyagon, but he is considered the first sefer ever written on Jewish philosophy. Now that has tremendous, tremendous consequences. For example, it means that when we look at the Gemara, while there's no question in the Gemara, there are conversations about philosophy, right? At the end of the day, no book was ever written about Jewish philosophy and as Harvey put it, in a systematic manner. It didn't exist. So what we take for granted today, well, I'd say many people do, which is, for instance, arguments for God, the soul, free will, Tchias HaMesim, etc., there was no book ever written until Satyagon came along about those topics, okay? There's no question, not even a question, that both in content and style, there was a tremendous amount of influence that Satyagon had from Islamic philosophers who themselves were influenced by the Greek philosophers. And that's not a bad thing. A lot of the ideas that Islamic philosophers came up with played a big role in a good way in influencing and clarifying a lot of the approaches that Jewish philosophers take. And you'll see the style of writing also is very, very Islamic philosopher style. And that's actually a very, very interesting perspective, interesting thing to see about Satyagon. Okay, so his introduction, he calls it Doubt and Certainty, and it's divided up into sections, okay? And the style that Satyagon uses is that it's a style of questions, certain premises he brings in place, and then proofs, okay? That's a very, and again, that actually comes from Kalam or an Islamic approach, but the idea is that you state certain questions, you introduce premises, or for those who were with me with Kreskes before, what we'll call rational speculation, and then you come to take those rational speculations and justify them with proofs, okay? And it's what's interesting is that, whereas today, certainly, and I'm not saying it's unique to today, we normally, you'll see people quoting from Gemara's right and left, not Satyagon, nor, for instance, Rabbachi and Pekuda and Chovos Levavos. They do not quote from Gemara's. They will on occasion, but 90% of the time, they use Tanakh as a method of proving their points, okay? Almost as if to say to the Karaites, which one of the reasons why he's writing the book, we know how to darshan out from the Torah to use as a proper proof. Okay, so doubt and certainty, okay? So what he comes up by saying is that is what is the first thing he wants to do before he actually gets into what the Emunos Vadeos will talk about, okay? He first says is that he's very concerned because what's happened, the people around him have become very doubtful. They've questioned a lot. They become skeptical. Now, I wouldn't call an advanced form of skepticism like that exists today, and I'm not using advanced with a positive connotation. It's more that people, they just didn't have a firm grasp of any sort of Jewish philosophy. Now, that also raises some interesting questions, which is that, was it that people had it and lost it, or was it that it never was that strong, and then there were certain external influences and causes that were bringing this about? It's a good question, what exactly caused people to become doubtful, but what Satyagon wants to do is, he wants to introduce methods that will assist people to resolve those doubts. Very simple, it's a very simple goal. You have questions about belief in God, I'm going to show you the methods that you can use to resolve those conflicts. I mean, it's literally like the Sefer is written in a very clinical style. It's that, this is your problem, here's a solution. That's your problem, that's your solution. And that's the style that he's going to employ throughout. But the main point is that what's the purpose of Emunos Vadeos? It's there to help you get past these supposed existential crises or these situations of suffering. All these situations, he's there to push you and get you, past that those humps in the road. And often what ends up happening, and at least according to Satyagon, is that when someone's besuffic, when someone isn't quite sure of the right approach to take or what to believe in, what ends up happening is that their state of uncertainty, as they'll explain later on, becomes accepted as a truth itself, okay? And that was something unacceptable to Satyagon. He did not want a person to be satisfied with being in a state of suffic, okay? And again, like I mentioned in the beginning, this idea here of this has nothing to do, I mean, he's bringing it because of what's happening in Judaism, okay? There's no question about it. But it has nothing to do with Judaism itself. It means, in general, if you have a doubt about anything, anything at all, okay, the style that Sajigon employs will help you. That's doubt and certainty. His Akdama is all about teaching you the methods to help you resolve any doubt you might have. If you don't ever plan on reading Emunas Fideos, you won't have to. Meaning you can apply this method to any part of life where any sort of doubt exists. Okay, so it's a pretty lofty objective that he's trying to achieve just in this Hakdama. Okay, so the first thing he takes up is, how do you become uncertain? What leads someone into the state of uncertainty? Okay, so he explains that that knowledge, okay, is primarily acquired via the use of the empirical. What that means is that, how do I obtain knowledge of the world around me? Through my five senses. So my five senses, my eyes are there's photons, my retinas, they go into the retinas, there's translation of my brain, etc. I acquire knowledge through the sensory. And that's very normal, okay? But the thing is like this, even though I acquire knowledge through my senses, okay, there could be a confusion of what I'm actually perceiving. Now he's not talking about an optical illusion. I'll show you what he's talking about in a second. But the fact, just because I, normally speaking, my acquisition of knowledge through the sensory works, I could become confused. But why would a person become confused? Okay. So one reason why a person could be confused is because you're not quite sure what you're trying to gain information about using your senses. I'll give you an example in a second. The other possibility is that the person is not serious enough in the pursuit of the information through his senses. So what do I mean? So I'll give you an example that happens in my house, okay? So my son, it doesn't matter which one, is looking for a specific flavor of Ben & Jerry's in our freezer, okay? Now, there's two possibilities of why he may fail. Number one is he may not be aware of the name of the flavor, which will lead him to not recognize that which he is seeking. So if he's lacking a piece of information in what he's trying to achieve through acquiring information through his senses, he may be confused about the outcome because he doesn't remember the name of the flavor. Or the other possibility is that, especially in my freezer, he takes one look at the freezer and he decides that digging around through the 55 layers of food that exist in the freezer to see if the Ben & Jerry's is underneath that, it's not worth the effort. So he'll never acquire the outcome of that flavor that he's looking for because he doesn't want to put in the effort. So according to Sajigon, those are the two reasons why someone may not get the expected outcome. And of course, what's the flavor? Without question, don't argue about this. Half-baked is definitely the best, flavor of Ben & Jerry's that exists. Okay? Now Ellie's going to be relaxed now. Take this idea, the next thing he does in the Hakdama is, he says, let's apply this to our minds, okay? He says, when it comes to acquiring, let's say, intellectual information, an individual can reach an erroneous conclusion due to not being familiar or educated in the methodology required, okay? So let's say, for instance, I want to understand how relativity works. If I don't have any knowledge of how the methodology of physics itself, it's going to be very difficult. It's probable that it will come to the wrong conclusion as a result, okay? As well, a person can reach an erroneous conclusion if steps are skipped and shortcuts are taken. That's a very syllogistic way of looking at things. Sajigon is a big believer in a very slow and methodical approach to things. So if a person has he wants to understand something about a certain area, you must go through each step. Each step must be taken. If you skip any step along the way, that could definitely lead you to an erroneous conclusion. Just like if you're putting together a syllogism, a complex logical argument, if you skip any step or any premise, it could lead to the entire conclusion falling apart. Okay, and again, that's what I'm saying at the bottom here. This all is how Aristotelian arguments work. So again, according to Sajigon, when we move to the mind, okay, a person can come to a mistaken conclusion, either A, because he's ignorant, okay, about how it works, or B, because you're lazy. Okay, so the same way how those two can apply in empirical information, they can also apply when it comes to seeking out truths in the world. So that's the move he's making right now, okay? Okay, so far so good. Any questions before I go on? Okay. Now, it turns out there's one more thing, okay? The thing he adds to this, okay, is that if a person has no idea what they're looking for at all, okay, then of course what's going to happen? What's going to happen is they're going to for sure come to an erroneous conclusion. So the one extra thing he adds is because of this line right here. Because he found in his time that he felt that there are some people who, let's say, their ignorance of what they're trying to seek out could be rectified, right? And it's really, you know, it's not a malicious error on their part. That's like someone smart who has a flaw in his line of reasoning. But these people are in his mind, amaratzim. These are people who basically, they don't know what they're seeking at all, okay? They're just like walking around blind. They have no idea what they're looking for. They're confused. People could stumble upon the truth, right? It is possible, but they have no idea that they hit the truth to begin with, okay? So it'd be like, imagine, and this gets to a very core idea in taking a philosophical approach to Judaism, right? That a person can come to, let's say, according to Sajigon, if a person came to the conclusion at this point, the conclusion, let's say that I believe in God, right? Or I believe in the Torah, but I have no reason why he did. Sajigon would hold that's a problem. He doesn't want you to just get to the conclusion. He wants you to go through the process. He holds that rational speculation is critical to achieving truth. Just because a person stumbled upon the truth has no meaning whatsoever to him. Okay, it's in Sajigon's world, it's worthless. Now, and I don't think, it's not that he denies lo lishma balishma. He's just saying that in a philosophical sense, if a person came to such a conclusion, it would be a worthless thing. Okay, so now he says like this, okay? Sajigon loves lists, okay? So if you do plan on reading Emunas Vadeos, get ready for tons and tons of lists. He's a big listing guy, okay? So this is what Sajigon claims that he's observed about people, okay? He's observed some people who obtain truth and are happy, meaning people who've gone through the necessary methodological steps of whatever area they're pursuing, they obtain truth and they're happy as a result. There are other people who they do obtain truth, but they're still not convinced. Now that's a critical thing. I can tell you that I have to say this carefully. Like, I've definitely had conversations with people where you can demonstrate to them why a theory makes perfect sense, right? And that person you're speaking to really has no clear argument against the theory that you're proposing. They'll just say, I'm not convinced. And of course you ask them, well, what's stopping you from being convinced? They can't put their finger on it, but they say they're not convinced. That's what he's talking about. There's people who, what do you call it? There are people who can see the truth for what it is, but for some reason they're in doubt about something, okay? And then there's people who have it all backwards, who think what is false is true and what is true is false. They're just completely obviously confused. And then there's another type of person, and this is one he's very cautious about, people who dip their toes in various systems of thought. That's my way of paraphrasing it. What it means is that it's like a person looks at different philosophies and ideologies as like trying out different types of food, okay? I'll take a little taste of this, a little taste of that, but they never actually really immerse themselves in any one of the systems, okay? So these are the types of people that Sajigon has come across in his life. There's people who are happy with the truth. There are people who get to this point of truth, but are not quite convinced. There are people who have it all wrong. And then there are people who never, what do you call it, take any system that seriously. They kind of try everything out for themselves. Of course, the question is, he doesn't ask this, but who would you want as your friends? Who would you want to be friends with of those four kinds of people? So now he gets to what his mission is, okay? His mission, and it's an amazing thing because he definitely is an anav, like most authors of great svarim. He has humility, okay? But he feels like taking upon himself this responsibility. Because what he saw is, he says, he saw that rational people in the world were sunk, as it were, in seas of doubt and overwhelmed by waves of confusion, okay? And there was no diver or swimmer to help them. But who's going to help them out? Sajigon. This is his mission. His mission is, he sees people are in this state of confusion. They're sunk. They're sunk in their ways. They're stuck. It's like quicksand. Sajigon's going to help them out. So he's here to help those people out who are, you know, sunk as it would be. But he does express humility, and he recognizes how challenging this task is. I mean, he's taking upon himself the mission to save Jews, right, from what he would consider to be potential heresy. That's his job, okay? Okay. But of course, normally, in I'd say most secular authors, they begin the book at that point. But not Satyagraha. He's not done yet. Okay? He has to go back now and take up more issues of how doubt and certainty work. Okay? So he says as follows. He says, he wants to know, it's an amazing question. Why would God allow, I mean, it's an astonishing question to ask. Why would God allow for such uncertainties and doubts to exist and become predominant among his creatures? Why would God allow for such a thing? Why would God create a world where such things exist, where people are going to end up hitting points of suffix? Okay? Why would God allow for such a thing? Okay? So what he first says, and then we can discuss this in a second, what he first says is, and this is exactly what he says, it was necessary to be that way. Okay? Now, of course, the problem is that, what he says over here, v'chayv lahem a suffix v'ashibush. Now, of course, that's not answering the question. You can't say the reason why God, you can't raise the question of why did God do it this way and say because it was necessary to do that way, because that's not really answering the question. Then the entire question itself was a ridiculous question. So at that point, if you're reading the introduction, you would just say to yourself, what have we accomplished at this point? But he tries to explain what he means, okay? He says like this, it's a very cryptic line. He says, by the plan of creation, they require for every act they perform a span of time within which to complete that act step by step. Okay? So what the heck does that mean? What does that mean? He says, it's the nature of tasks in this world that they be completed step by step. Okay? So think about it this way. Okay? Let's think about, as an example, you go to IKEA and you buy that, let's say, what's a comp? Okay. I had this one here, okay? I think the first year Yeshiva opened, I went to IKEA and I bought one of those Aronot, okay, for the guys to put their clothes in. Okay, I took out the instructions. I was pretty sure I was following, and it was like 30 pages, okay? And I don't know, for those who know IKEA, you know, you get, all you need is that little tiny screwdriver thing, and that's it, and they claim you're good to go. Yeah, that red, the Allen wrench, right? And they have those pictures, and it seems so intuitive, and I thought I was following every single step perfectly, and of course, at the end, somehow it just, there was something way off about it. I think the problem was I put the backside on backwards. But anyway, when in putting together the IKEA furniture, right, it's a step-by-step process, right? It's not just, here's the Aron, there is, to, you know, the parts, and then adding this to this, and putting this together, step-by-step. So what Satyagraha explains is that God created the universe, or the world, in a way where there are tasks that we do, and these tasks go step by step, okay? You can use, there's a zillion analogies you can think of. Cooking, building a car, building's the easy one. Learning something, okay? And that's the key. When you learn something, it's a step-by-step process. So because it's a step-by-step process, okay, so cognition, which is the acquisition of knowledge, must also follow this step-by-step process. So if that's the case, okay, what can happen? And again, he's going to get to this answer of why did God do it this way. Just give me a minute here. We begin, what happens when we think? We begin first with this messy mix of information. So what Satyagraha's doing is very, reflects the way early logicians thought about logic, which is essentially slow down how you think. Okay, imagine, it's a very difficult thing to do. When we think, we never stop to think how we think. Okay. What Satyagraha is going to do right now is he's going to attempt, using a little bit of his science of the times, but he's going to attempt to stop and go step by step to understand how, when you think about something, how you go from the acquisition of information through the use of cognition, step by step to a conclusion. So what do you begin with? You begin with a primordial soup of information. It's a big mess, okay? And then you take the mess of information that's bringing into your mind. Now, he's not talking about photons. In his, it's a little bit different what he's talking about. But the point is that what you do is the information you have around you, as your brain, your mind starts taking it in, it starts refining it and purifying the information. Okay, and as you continue down the road, the natural uncertainties that exist in this messy mix of information become purified and refined. And it gets cleaner and cleaner and cleaner and clearer and clearer and clearer until finally you get to the essence of what the thing is. So, for instance, let's take this teacup that I have in front of me, okay? So none of us would ever think for a second, how did I get to the conclusion that this is a teacup, okay? And again, noting that teacup is the essence of this thing. What Sajigun would say is that, well, let's start from the beginning. Your eyes pick up this information about the teacup. They process it. Your brain slowly starts figuring out, what is this thing? Well, it's not this. It's not that. It's not that. It has this characteristic, that characteristic, that characteristic. You keep refining the various possibilities of what this could be until finally you get to teacup. That's what Sajigun says, why uncertainties exist. Uncertainties exist because and that's what he meant also, that it's necessary. Uncertainties exist because the process of thinking itself is a process of going from a initial starting point of complex, messy, and then slowly going through a refining and purification process until finally get to a clarity of a conclusion. Okay, now that may, yeah, agreed. So it's a funny thing. He 100%. He does dodge the initial question because he's not really explaining why God had to make it this way. All he's saying is that he's just trying to explain how the idea of uncertainty is almost like a natural part of the world. But that doesn't really answer the question. There's no, you're right. I mean, ultimately, it doesn't really answer why God had to do it this way. But what it does do, though, is that it elevates the process of thinking to the highest possible level. That, to me, in my opinion, is the critical point here. Sajigun wants you to understand that there is nothing better, okay? There's nothing better than us going through this process of thinking. Because ultimately what we're doing is we take information from the world around us and we get to whatever truth we're looking for. And it's getting to the truth that's the ultimate thing. So for Sajigun, and this certainly is the, I would argue, is the dominant theory of the rational thinking in Judaism, thinking is the most important thing. That's where a person really gets involved in understanding truth. And to do that, you must go through these various steps. Of course, a person can choose to stop the process, but what he's trying to tell you is that the most important thing for a person to be engaged in is thinking. And then when a person thinks, there's a methodical way to think. Now, again, can a person choose not to think? Of course. Although in choosing not to think, you're thinking about choosing not to think. So you're always thinking at first. So even if you want to talk about free will, you must use thinking to even discuss free will. So getting back to the question you just asked, I would say, well, let's think about free will. Well, what is free will? And we would start with a messy mix of information. In this case, I'd say expectation of what we want free will to be, human conception, experience, etc., and then refine it until we come to the essence of what we think free will is. So that would prove why thinking is so important. The very idea of free will itself requires me to use my mind to think about it, okay? So that's the first thing he says. Okay. Yeah. So now Sajigun brings in the next step in his Hakdama is the 10-step guide. Okay. So like I said before, he slows down the process of thinking. And what I just said before about taking the mess and refining it, he uses examples. And this is about like 6 pages in Hakdama. I'm not going to go through every specific thing here. But he says, for example, when you hear a person speak, okay, they are necessary but unrecognized, meaning you're not really aware of them, steps involved, such as removing noise that has nothing to do with the speech. I have a great book at home on the philosophy of perception and how hearing works and the slow steps involved and why we trust the way we hear. Sajjan goes through that. He says, when you hear someone speaking, it's not immediate that you hear them speak. Rather, what happens is that first there's isolating the noise, then taking the noise and understanding the letters, then letters into words, then words into sentences, and eventually you're led to the point of constructing a valid argument with true premises. So he uses the example of hearing stuff, okay, to get to what it called hearing someone speak to get to the point of this 10-step guide of refining, 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 and getting to the truth. Okay. Okay. Next, he moves into some advice. Okay. Sajigun, he likes to give us some good advice. He says that the most important thing is that if you stop too early in the process, what's going to happen? Well, let's take the example of, I'm trying to figure out what this is. I'm trying to figure out what this teacup is, the essence of the teacup, okay? I know I gave it away in saying that, but let's say I'm trying to find that out. Now, what will happen is that, let's say I stop at step four. Let's pretend step four is, well, I know this thing is not metal, okay? Well, I still have a lot of uncertainties. I still don't know necessarily what this is, right? I've certainly removed some other possibilities, but I haven't really got to the essence of what the thing is. So what Sajigun would say is that when you stop too early in a methodical process of thinking, naturally speaking, what's going to happen is you're going to have doubt. And so that's why he says, finish off this, you know, take it all the way to the end. Now, of course, someone would ask, how do you know you've hit the end point? That's a good question, okay? But what he says is, that's the key. Okay, now he moves into the idea of belief, okay? So anyone have any you know, belief is something that carries a tremendous amount of weight to the term. We can argue, all sorts of different religions and ideologies, and even within Judaism, different ideas of what belief is. Sajigon lays out what he considers belief to be. And it's a critical idea in actually the Sefer Emunos V'Deos, because he wants you to get to the point where going, in other words, when a person arrives at the truth of something, it's not just enough to arrive at the truth, but then to believe that that thing is true. So what does belief mean? As he says here in Hebrew, Mahi Ha'emunah. So he says, when a person follows the above steps and then understands whatever conclusion he's come to, that conclusion is true, what ends up happening, and this is literally what he says, you have this feeling of being convinced, you take this idea, this truism that you came up with, and you deposit it into your soul. I'll use the mind, okay? I think it's easier to think of it in terms of the mind. In other words, once I know this idea is true, I take it and I put it into like my idea safe deposit box to be withdrawn at a later date. Okay, so it's a very unique way of looking at belief. According to Sajigon, when I believe in something, what does that mean? It means that what we would use today, maybe the terminology would be, is internalizing it. Meaning I take it, I make it part of who I am. Okay, he words it insofar as depositing into a soul. But what I think what he's really saying is that a person takes the true concept and really makes it part of their being. That's belief as far as Sajigon is concerned. It's a very different idea than I think a person normally would think of belief, okay? That's an excellent point. Often the word faith, it's almost like there's a disdain to go through a thinking process, meaning better just to have faith that things will work out than go through the thinking process itself. The only thing I would say, though, is that, and this is, I think, a critical difference between... I apologize, and there's music in the background here. A critical difference in belief then and belief today is that often what we'll do today is that, I give this example all the time, when you get on a plane, okay, Sajigon wouldn't necessarily agree with this. When I get on a plane, right, there's definitely a lack of information I have about the plane, right? A plane is not like the teacup. The teacup, I can get to the essence of teacup. By a plane, I kind of know how a plane works. I don't really know the pilot at all. I don't know any of these specifics about the plane, and yet I believe that the best decision to make is to get on the plane and to fly to wherever I'm going to because of previous experiences, the scientific method, etc. So often we use inductive reasoning and we use belief to close the gap that exists in inductive reasoning. But whatever. The point, though, is that, as Yonah, you're 100% right, there's no question this is different than faith. Faith today, often, the idea of faith is a disdain for thinking about things. Rather just believe in it, or excuse me, have faith and it's all good. But Sajigon vehemently disagrees with such an idea. Okay? Now, Sajigon then says that a chacham, what does a chacham do? It sounds like a very lofty idea. They take reality and they make it their guiding principle, and therefore you base your belief on whatever reality is. Now, of course, again, what is reality? He doesn't define what reality is. He just says, that's what you do. Whereas, now this is a very critical point. A fool sets up his personal conviction as his guiding principle, assuming that reality is patterned after his belief. That is a critical point, okay? I can't emphasize it enough. First of all, it's a logical fallacy. And second of all, often people do that. I find this often where someone comes in, their conclusion is already built in. They have their conclusion set up, and then it's just a question of forcing the argument to fit their conclusion. That's a very, very dangerous way to approach any area of information. I find it often when it comes to, let's say, for instance, let's say sometimes I'll be teaching Gemara somewhere, and someone will say, yeah, but what do you call it? They'll have a certain assumption of how the rabbis thought, and because of that, let's say a certain bias the rabbis had, now they'll jam the entire message of the Gemara to fit that conclusion. That's a very dangerous idea, right? We cannot let personal conviction be our guiding principle. We must assume first, we must try to be objective and follow the, again, whatever reality means here, use that as a guiding principle, and then belief is the result. Not set up belief first and then try to jam the facts into that belief. And that, to me, is an extremely important point that has just as much relevance today as it had in the times of Sajagon. Okay, now Sajagon moves into, well, where can I find these truths? Okay, what's the source of truth? Okay, now this is also, today would never fly today. Okay, so Sajagon says there are three sources of truth. Okay, number one, there's knowledge obtained through the empirical. Okay, where my five senses, what I look around me and what I hear and what I see and what I touch and feel, that's one type of knowledge that can be source and truth. Another one is what he calls the intuition of the intellect. Okay, which means concepts that arise uniquely in the human mind. Okay, there's a whole reason why he says that. But intuition is a very big idea for Sajagon and many of the philosophers of that era. The idea that there are certain concepts that are unique to the human mind. You don't need the empirical for, but they're there anyway. And then finally, he has knowledge that's derived from logical necessity, which means that if I form a logical argument, so then at the end of the day, whatever the conclusion is necessary as a result. So again, there's three sources of truth. Okay, there is knowledge obtained through the empirical. There is the intuition, the intellect, which means concepts that are unique to the human mind. And finally, knowledge that comes about through, let's say, logical arguments, where the conclusion is a necessary result. Those are the three ways someone can obtain truth, okay? But what's missing, okay? What's missing, go ahead. What's amazing now is that Sajagon now makes a tremendous move. His move is that, and this is what makes Sajagon's approach in the Hagdama and in Munus Vadeos different than any other book written that time on philosophy, which is that there's another source of truth that we could look to, and that is our Mesorah. Okay, now that's another word that carries so much weight. I mean, we love using the word Mesorah. Everyone has a Mesorah for something, right? Every minhag has a Mesorah. It's amazing how that word today, in my opinion, is overused. He's not talking about that. He's talking about, as you'll see, he's talking about strictly the Torah itself and the words of the prophets. When he refers to Mesorah, he really means the words of the prophets. But what he says is that there's another source of truth that Jews can turn to, meaning not the empirical, not concepts like triangle, not logical deduction, but rather our Mesorah. Okay? Now, why is that such a critical point? Because often people will sometimes suspend, and this is key, they'll suspend the empirical, they'll suspend the intuition, they'll suspend logical deduction for the sake of Mesorah. Sajagon never says that one trumps the other, okay? He's looking for a symmetry, some type of synchronization between the three general sources of truth and the Mesorah, okay? And the Mesorah, as you'll see in Sajagon's world, is actually there to buttress the other three, okay? That's what's amazing about Sajagon. Whereas in certain streams of Jewish ideology, the Mesorah comes first. And even if the Mesorah contradicts or challenges the first three, they would take the Mesorah. But Sajagon would never say that. Sajagon holds, as you'll see, that the Mesorah is there simply, in quotes, to buttress those other three sources of truth. What's an example? An example he uses is that we used our senses to authenticate Sinai, okay? We used our empirical observation. We were there, or the people were there, and they saw and heard what took place, and that's what they used to authenticate Sinai. And then later on, our tradition buttresses, right, supports that claim. So there was the empirical experience of Sinai, which is a source of truth, i.e. empiricism. And then the Mesorah, meaning it becomes part of our history or our Mesorah, that's just simply there to support that thing. First of all, I'll give you like an absurd hypothetical, right? As an example, like let's say in the Mesorah, whatever that means, the Mesorah says that a square is a circle, okay? So what Sajagon would say is that it's an impossibility. Of course it's an impossibility that a square can be a circle, but he would say that there's some flaw in the Mesorah, and he would trust the logical reality of a square not being a circle. Again, according to Sajagon, the Mesorah is there to corroborate the validity of the first three sources of knowledge. So it's there again. It's a raya. Now again, to me, that's very astonishing because that goes against, I would say, you could even argue a lot of mainstream positions of how we look at the Masorah. Okay, all right, good. Yes, so that's a good question because you could argue that the Masorah only came about because of those three things, right? You could never have a Masorah if it weren't for empirical observation, etc. You're right. I agree. Right, because that itself was based on those three truths, right? But well, I'm going to ignore that. What do you call it? That's a good point. That's a good point. You're right. You're 100% right. Okay. Just because of time, let me just move to the next few slides. So now Sajagon moves to his next list. Okay. So Sajagon loves logical inference. That's one of his best the tools that he loves using most. Okay. And he says there are seven important considerations one must take into account to determine if any logical conclusion is actually correct. Okay. And again, notice how, again, in other words, this is where if I came to a conclusion, okay, in order to be 100% certain it's correct, there's a certain test that I can I can put the conclusion through to make sure that it's true. Okay. One second. Did I skip a slide? Sorry about that. Hold on. Sorry, hold on one second. Oops. Yeah, okay. So again, so it's always about being thorough, okay? Okay, so now he brings up another very, interesting question. He says, people tend to think that philosophical speculation is forbidden, as it could lead to heresy, okay? That's a normal belief, okay? That people think, how can you get involved in philosophical speculation? And there were chachamim during his period when he lived that thought such an approach is usur. What is he also alluding to? He's alluding to the Gemara. Because the Gemara in Chagiga talks about, the Mishnah says, you can't engage in these areas of philosophical speculation. It could lead someone to become a kofar. So he says, that's ridiculous. Sajagon says, of course a person can engage in philosophical speculation. He says, for instance, you have other svarim like Eov, which he learns Eov to be similar to the Rambam, in a very Greek style, a discussion, a philosophical discussion about divine providence. So you see that. And he gives other examples also where the very idea of philosophical speculation is, right, something that exists within Jewish Svarim. So then what did Chazal Aser when it comes to speculation? This is very difficult. So he says, and I'm going to leave this more as a question. He says, you can't speculate about creation, which refers to the beginning of time and place, okay, or is Makom and Zman. Those or Ace. Those two things you're not allowed to speculate on. Now, we got to be careful because he's not thinking in terms of our idea of physics today. And it's tough to, you have to understand from an Aristotelian standpoint what he's talking about. Ultimately, the concern of heresy that he's referring to is that you'll come to believe that the universe eternally exists. And that's a denial of an ikkar in Judaism. So finally, this is around page 30 or so, or 29. Finally, Sajjon gets to the objective of his sefer. Okay? Why write Emunas Vadeos? Okay? Notice, up to this point in time, he's literally laid out universal principles of how to think, how to question, how to be methodical. So why write this book? So he says, I'll tell you why. He says, I'm writing this book to verify the truths as presented by the Nevi'im. Okay, so the Nevi'im presents various arguments, and he wants to show you how to verify them to be true. He wants to refute the arguments of all the skeptics, the people who are who have attacked Judaism, and then he spent some time developing the rationale for why you should believe what the prophets had to say. So finally, he ends off with one last question, okay? He says, if rational speculation, and this is so critical, if you're telling me that philosophy is really lichatchila, the way a person should come to MS, if rational speculation, right, if the ideal existence of a person, the state of a person is to come to the conclusion of God, like the Rambam describes as Avram did, which basically is through a rational speculation. So why would God use Nisim and other types of things as a way to present the truth of Himself? Meaning, why did God say at Sinai, rather than overwhelm us with this empirical light show, why not just say, listen, let me show you the various steps you should use. to get to me. Okay, or don't even give us the steps. Allow us to engage in the speculation. So Sajagon says, I'll tell you why. I swear, this is what he says. He says, because it takes time. It takes a lot of time to go through those steps. And here's the problem. If we, as a Jewish people, at the time of Sinai, went through those steps ourselves, inevitably we would make mistakes. Remember, going back to taking the primordial soup of information and refining it out, if we were left on our own to try to come to rational arguments about God, we would botch it, okay? And then during the period of time that we'd be going through these steps to try to conclude about God, you know what would happen? We would have no attachment to any religion whatsoever. So God did not want any moment in time for us to be detached from Judaism. So what does he do? He uses the quick fix method of miracles, meaning overwhelm us with miracles, and then through our empirical observation, we have no choice but to conclude that God is true. But we don't go through what he would consider to be the better way, which is a methodical step-by-step process that leads you to the conclusion of God being true. Okay? So he says, therefore, the empirical reality forced us to accept God and the Torah as being true. That's actually the language he uses. We had no choice. But that's not, so to speak, the best way of coming to that conclusion. So what do we do today? We rely both on the Mesorah, right? Again, the history of what happened, along with our own rational speculation, drive at the same conclusion. So getting back to what I think Eli asked before, this is where he kind of brings these points together. What he says is that, well, in the Torah never gives me a rational argument for God. Rather, what it says is that we believed in the truth of God because of Sinai, right? It was the overwhelming event of Sinai. That's what led us to the belief in God, okay? right. But what we also are supposed to do, the other thing we should engage in is we should engage in rational speculation to arrive at that same conclusion. And in many ways, Sajagon would argue that in some ways it's better to go through the rational speculation approach, okay? Yes. So now he says, why don't Kofrim believe in miracles, okay? And why don't they attempt to engage in any type of religious speculation? So he gives, I kid you not, he gives eight reasons why, which I didn't go into all the details, but basically says, because people are, and some of these are fallacies here, but people are dumb, or people are too involved in the physical world, or what we will call ADHD. He actually says people can't focus. Arrogance, they buy into weak argument, people hated monotheists. Also, there are all sorts of reasons why people never decide to go into this rational speculation. Meaning there are people who are kofrim, and he says, how is it possible they can accept kafir as being true? Because again, in his mind, a heretic would believe that false is true and true is false. It's because of these eight reasons, okay? Those are what lead them to that conclusion. And finally, at the end of the Hakdama ends with this. He ends with the table of contents, and that's how the Hakdama ends. So it's amazing how, I think it's like 32, 33 pages into Emunos Vadeos, it's only at that point they actually list the table of contents of what the Sefer contains. Okay?